And I speak for the majority of the board on this. And also, as you continue in your deliberation, Mr. Bachman and Mr. Daniels will be available, and they will be speaking for the majority of the board of Washington County.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming up. Representative Parkinson.
I detect an inconsistency, and I think maybe I know the answer. We've heard that Washington County was a pioneer in land use planning, and I think we heard a lot of testimony the other day that Washington County also has probably as much parcelization as most any other county. Would that be because of the demands for housing from the metropolitan area, or it seems inconsistent?
Yeah, the county tripled population between 60 and 80, and that was because of the rapid growth in the metropolitan area. The majority of the growth during that period has occurred in Washington County. And with that has caused some parcelization on some of the marginal land, some of the hillside areas. But that parcelization occurred in accord with the county's comprehensive plan adopted before LCDC. That is, in 73, the Board of County Commissioners adopted an AF 5 and 10 district in the same geography we're now talking as marginal lands. And a lot of that parcelization occurred in accord with the county's comprehensive plan. So there was a lot of 5 and 10 acre parcelization which occurred on these hillside areas of the Chehalem Mountains and around the fringes of the county. But the valley floor has been protected. What was then general farm use, and later it qualified as an exclusive farm use district for the Department of Revenue, and then was later in 82 transferred to an exclusive farm use district, protected the valley floor. So the prime farmlands have been kept without parcelization. The hillside areas have been allowed to parcelize in accord with the county's comprehensive plan, which predated LCDC.
And what has happened in the past is has come back to haunt us now, because some of these roads with the 5 and 10 acre lots built, the houses built on these, are beginning to demand urban services, and they don't begin to carry that cost. The urban portion of the county is beginning to have to pay for some of the services they're being demanding. We just, that's enough.
Madam Chairman, if I have just one final comment, would be on the issue of the urban growth boundary. It may seem almost insignificant or some bit of a quirk, but it's important for the legislature and at the urging of this committee that all lands inside urban growth boundaries are not, the long term is not to preserve for farmland, that lands inside the boundary have been deemed to be necessary for growth between now and the year 2000, and for us to also say that we want to protect those farmlands through the application of Goal 3 is going to cause pressure on the urban growth boundary in points where we don't want it to occur. So, and that's why in the metropolitan area, we didn't adopt the urban growth boundary through a comprehensive plan. It was assigned to a regional agency, and the regional agency adopted the boundary, and it's important that we not apply Goal 3 inside that boundary.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
We've heard two or three times that this is a majority position. Are you inferring that there is a minority position on the commission?
Yeah, I think there is a minority. It's 3-2 and possibly 4-1. As there is on most commissions.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for coming and testifying today.
Thank you.
We do have people from Salem that we've brought here asked specifically to answer questions. And if they would be so patient, and Scott, if you would be so patient to wait, we do have people that came from some distance that did not testify the other day, and I want to make sure that we get through all of these today. Gary Sundquist from Washington County. And I appreciate all of your patience for waiting. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Gary Sundquist, and I'm a farmer in Washington County. My family has been involved with a small farm in Washington County for roughly the last quarter of a century. I'm also involved in a local community planning organization, which was established by the county as a method of complying with Goal 1 to have citizen involvement in the land use plan. I've been involved in that for several years. As the last couple of years, I've been the vice chairman of that. I've been in charge of the committee that deals exclusively with rural land use in the county. And I do not represent the organization itself, but I would as from that perspective, I've been involved in Washington County. And I think this bill that we're dealing with is a very positive bill. I think it's very positive in that it establishes a definition for marginal lands. In the last several years, in going to hearings, when people wanted to convert farmland to some other use, I have never heard anybody come in and say, this is a prime piece of agricultural land. They always call it marginal land, despite the fact that it may be class 1, 2, or 3 soils. In some cases, I've seen them call marginal land land that is in 100% wheat production now. So I think it's a good deal to have a definite definition for what marginal land is, so when someone comes in and claims marginal land, there's a definition. It either meets this criteria or it does not meet this criteria. I also think it's a very positive step in that it tightens the restrictions on non-farm dwellings and the exclusive farm use land. Throughout the last 25 years in the county, I've witnessed a great deal of development. I think Washington County is possibly the largest growing area in the county, and I've witnessed a great deal of agricultural land that has been converted to non-farm use. There will be a continuing amount of farmland converted to non-farm use because of very large urban growth boundary. Also, roughly 23,000 acres of the plan was approved by LCDC through the exceptions process, so there will be continuing development that's outside of the urban growth boundary because of over 23,000 acres that's designated through the exceptions process. And this has a drastic effect upon farmers in the area. The ability to continue farming is in some respect largely due to the perception the farmer has of his ability to continue farming. The National Agricultural Land Study that was done under the Carter administration and released under the Nixon administration caused one of the main problems for the failure of farming enterprises is what they call the impermanence syndrome. They see a lot of development around on-farm areas that were productive farm, and they're being developed for other uses, and the perception is that this is the wave of the future. This is what's going to eventually happen to my farm. They then neglect the investment that's needed for farm machinery, farm buildings, to carry on a productive process, and as a result, they essentially become unproductive because they don't believe they can survive in the future. Throughout our county, there has been a great deal of non-farm dwellings that have been established on exclusive farm use land throughout the last years. The Thousand Friends study on non-farm dwellings did not include Washington County because it did not have an established comprehensive land use plan, so I can't tell you exactly how many non-farm dwellings have been approved, but I know within my just immediate geographic area that there have been some 5 in the last few years that have been established. I know on the Tuesday, these dwellings do cause conflict with existing farm uses, and I know at the hearing on Tuesday it was pointed out that the Right to Farm bill negates some of these problems, but it in no way negates all of these problems. These dwellings continue to cause some conflicts. I've had problems in my area from people walking their pets in my field, playing with their dogs on my field, which has a tendency to trample down a seed crop. I have, after the 4th of July, gone around my hay barn and picked up 4th of July rockets, which were fired in that direction. Up in eastern Oregon, my sister lost one of their prime bulls because the neighbors had pulled up their peas from the garden and decided this was a perfect opportunity. They just threw them over the fence for the animal to eat. It became bloated and died before it was possible to get to the animal. These things are not really, the neighbors aren't really intending to cause damage, but what happens is through ignorance of the environment they're located in, they do indeed cause conflicts. And the more developments there are in these areas, the more conflicts that arise, and I don't really think there's a realistic legal way to negate those conflicts once they're there. I think the prime objective is to stop these developments from occurring that are non-farm uses. I've been trying to expand my farm. My farm is not large enough to sustain full-time farming, and I would like to increase the size of my farm. And these non-farm uses have drastically, have essentially priced me out of the market for being able to extend my farm, because farmland that is zoned exclusive farm use in this area is perceived by real estate agents and those who are wanting to develop that eventually development will take place. The price reflects this. I have tried to acquire farmland in my area at a price of $3,000 an acre and been told that there was no way they would entertain any offer less than $7,000 to $8,000 an acre. Now, it's not because they're valuing this for farm use. They're valuing it for some perceived developmental right, which is not there. And I believe a tightening of the definitions on the non-farm dwellings will establish that this is not an acceptable use. This land is going to be used for exclusive farm use. And I think it will enable me to begin to acquire land at a price that is valued for the use of that land for farming uses. And that's what you need when you're trying to expand. I've heard the argument that these small parcels enable a young farmer to pick up a few acres here and a few acres there. The price is entirely too high, but you need to pick up a large enough piece of land so that the value can pay for the land and pay for the investment that you have to make in farm equipment and buildings. I think another positive aspect of this bill is the justification of a new farm, that in order to get a new farm dwelling, you have to prove that you can make $10,000 off of this property in 2 years or in two consecutive years, or else you've planted perennials that will produce this. This allows new farms that are legitimate new farms to establish. Customarily, when you establish a new farm, the investment is in crops, it is in equipment, it's not in building a house. And I think this will allow new farms to be established that are legitimate farms, and it'll prevent the loopholes that have been used to establish a rural residence, essentially, or a rural estate in an area that should be devoted to farming. I think another positive aspect of this bill is the granting of attorney's fees to the prevailing party in the abuse of a hardship dwelling. I've seen this in trying to acquire additional land, dwellings that were established as hardship uses but are no longer being used for hardship uses. They're being rented out to some non-farm person who is not associated with the farm. And it takes a great deal of expense if you were going to try and take a person to court on your own to make them comply with the existing law. I don't think it will cause frivolous lawsuits, because if you lost, you would have to pay your attorney's fees and the other attorney's fees, but it would make it realistic for actual violations of hardship dwellings to be rectified. There are some revisions to the Senate bill that I would like to see occur, and what I have is the copy of the Be Engrossed version.
That's what we want you to use.
Okay, thank you. On page 2, the significant contribution to a farm. I think everyone who has run across this does not like this provision, no matter what side you are on the issue. A significant contribution is just litigation looking for a place to happen. And I don't think it's necessary to put this sort of provision. I would like to see that change to the Agriculture for Oregon's suggestion. And I'm not certain that I understand the part about a contribution to a farm. I know in one farm in my area that has been held by corporate interests who are not engaged in farming for quite some time, there is a section of the land which was logged off and is left in stumps and grew up in blackberries when they acquired the land. They have not gone to the expense of clearing the land, but the land is being farmed. The remaining land is being farmed by farm operation. But that portion of the land is not contributing to the farm, but that doesn't mean that it couldn't contribute to the farm. And if someone owned the land who was engaged in agriculture, they would very quickly put that land into some kind of farm use. It can contribute, although it is not currently doing so. When we acquired our farm, we had some logged off portion of our farm that we went to a great deal of effort to clear, and the steepest portion of that is now in pasture use, and some of the other is in fruit tree production. So just because it isn't contributing at this point doesn't mean that it couldn't contribute to a farm operation, and I would not like to see those pieces of land that could contribute being turned over to housing. I would like the 100 acres changed back to the original 320 acres and to go from the 50% to the 60%. I don't think this is going to allow a tremendous amount of marginal land by going back to the other definition, but I don't think in the Willamette Valley there is a tremendous amount of marginal land. What this will allow by going back to the definition is those marginal lands that are indeed marginal lands, because they have been parcelized to the point where they cannot contribute to agriculture any longer. But I want to see that definition strict so it only applies to marginal land and does not allow additional land that can contribute to agriculture to be brought in. I also would like to see on page 2, line 5 and 6, the contiguous ownership defined as to what is contiguous ownership. The Agricultural for Oregon's suggestions seem to go a long way to rectifying this situation. I know in Washington County, a great deal of parcelization has occurred on paper only. It has not occurred in fact, and their parcels have been put in one the farmer's name, his wife's name, he and their name together, one of the children who, just one of the children's name. But in fact, this is one farm. I would like to see the law's definition to reflect that fact that this is indeed one farm, so we can get a definition that applies to what is out there in actuality and not just what has been put on paper to make it look like it's something it is not. The other I understand is on page 4, line 25, which is just an oversight which needs to be corrected, which is to delete farm unit or woodlot and to insert lot or parcel. I would not like to see it passed as it currently is, because if you had a small piece of land which you would simply be able to have the neighboring farmer take it into his operation for a couple of years, it would then be a part of a farm operation that was producing so much money, and you could get a farm dwelling established on that. I think the definition changed back to lot or parcel would establish that that money could be made off of that lot or parcel and not someone else's property. Something else that I would like to see reinstated is the entire Section 8 on the standing of any farmer in EFU being able to appeal a decision of a hearings officer. For some of the reasons that I'll try not to go over again, the non-farm dwellings being established in exclusive farm use has a tendency to affect all the farmers in the area, whether they happen to be right next door or a couple of miles away, because that non-farm dwelling leads to the feeling that that's going to continue throughout the county. And I think the question comes down to, is the objection to those dwellings established in law? Is it a violation of the goals? If it's a violation of the goals, that's what should be judged, not my right to bring the objection. Another portion I would like to see added. I have no idea why it was removed.
Representative Precinct.
Would you explain that to me again about your violation of the goals and your right to bring the objection?
If someone wants to establish a non-farm dwelling on a piece of exclusive farm use and it's in violation of the goals, it can't legally be done. I can bring the objection, but if I can't show that it directly affects me, my right to bring the objection can be disallowed, and it can be litigated all the way up to the Supreme Court, as it has on several occasions. Just my right to bring the objection, whether the objection makes sense or not, is not a factor in that standing.
In other words, he doesn't have standing because he is not directly mm-hmm. affected by it.
And I don't think it's going to bring frivolous lawsuits. I think my time is valuable, and I do not intend to bring frivolous lawsuits unless I think there is an honest violation of the goals. And I don't think I should have to prove every time that I have a right to bring the objection, and the decision whether that objection is right or wrong could be established right from the beginning instead of a long series of litigation.
Thank you.
One other thing I would like to have added back into it is permitted uses on farm land of that of a life estate. I do not know why it was removed from the Senate bill, but I know when we purchased our farm, this is a problem that we directly ran into. We negotiated to buy the entire farm, and at the last minute, the farmer's wife, who had been there for years and years, did not want to leave the land, and we ended up forming a non-farm dwelling for the farmer who was there beforehand. Now, it's passed on to other hands, and this is one of the areas where I get the tremendous conflict. This is where I get the 4th of July rockets aimed at my hay barn. They've done other things like firing off firearms when we were working with animals in close quarters that created a great deal of potential for personal injury. And I think it just makes sense that you could establish a life estate so a farmer could remain on his property, and at their death it would revert to the purchaser of the property. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary. I appreciate it. Glenn Patterson, who's been sitting there patiently. And I have a feeling I know what you're going to say, and it's going to be short.
Right. Half a page.
Unless you drag it out.
We're trying that.
Honorable Chairperson and members of the committee, I'm Glenn E. Patterson of the Seventh-day Adventist Church Northwest Headquarters, Department of Public Affairs. We appreciate that the Senate, in considering land use, and specifically in the EFU land in engrossed SB 237, made proper provision for education facilities and churches. The Oregon state laws governing land use have consistently allowed such building as an established right in the past, and we are concerned at any attempt to alter that position. We feel that altering that position to provisional use, as was suggested in previous testimony the other night, could engender prejudice, discrimination, and hardship. Proper education is one of Oregon's most important issues and should have full encouragement. I urge you not to alter Section 5 of engrossed SB 237 as found on page 3, lines 34 to 37, dealing with this issue. Thank you. That's all.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. Okay, we have Mr. Wilson, and then after that, Matt and Carl. One's from Benton, and one's from...
Is the Agriculture Department, are they here?
Yes. Well, we've had, we very patiently had someone from the Agriculture and Soils Classification sitting here waiting, but we haven't quite made it yet. And Forrester.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
You're welcome.
I welcome this opportunity to speak to the committee. I'm Bob Wilson, Route 2, Box 109, Monroe, Oregon. And just as a way of background, I'm chairman of the Benton County Planning Commission, and I'm also chairman of the South Benton Citizens Advisory Committee. I've been involved in the land use planning in Benton County since about 1976. As with Washington County, Benton County had a plan in the early 70s, which was thrown out with the baby in the bathwater. Because nothing seemed to comply, we had to start over and redo the whole comprehensive plan. At that time, the AF zone came up. We had AF 20, AF 40, which took in, at that time, what was called the mini farm or the small farm. And again, it was predominantly in those small acreages that in most cases had already been broken, followed the contours of the lower hills above the valley floor, followed the utility facilities along the highways and the paved roads, in some case gravel roads. But this was not a concept that was ready for its day in 1973. I'd like to go on record as I concur with the marginal lands concept, but again, I do not concur that 237 gives that priority to the public that needs it out there in some of these lands. And I'd just like to ask, on some of the testimony, to what extent agriculture? We have fought now for 10 years since Senate Bill 100 was put into place. And we continually use the concept that we're running out of farmland. Today, in the United States, we have 82 million acres that's sitting idle because it's producing too damn much. And as a consequence, 12% of the farm home loans are rapidly approaching default with nothing other than to go bankrupt. And yet we continuously tell ourselves that we have to save all of these 10, 15 acre, 20 acre pieces that fall within a broad brush category of usable lands, 1 through 4 in the case of exclusive farm use, and 2 through 6 in the case of woodlots. We have never applied in the broad brush approach something like the Huddleston report out of OSU that says, yeah, I can take any piece of land and designate it any damn thing I want it to, but unless I put water on it, I lose part of the capability. Unless I put fertilizer on it, I lose part of the capability. Unless I till it properly and take care of it properly, I lose part of the capability. And inversely, that I can call it farmland and give it a designation by the Soil Conservation Service of 1 through 4, but I must take that 4 soil and see what it consists of. And a perfect example is right next to my 111 acres in Benton County. There's a 52-acre piece that was split up in 1968. It has class 4 soil, and it's that deep. It's classified EFU. It doesn't even grow good weeds. Now, you can put ryegrass on it and get a partial crop of it. But there's probably 25,000 acres of ryegrass in Benton County. And that 52 acres or 20 acre portion that has this kind of land on it neither adds to nor detracts from the ryegrass situation. Quite adversely, we have found the ryegrass situation hit rock bottom because 5 years ago it was 17 cents a pound and everybody in the valley got into ryegrass. And part of the problem is a management problem. If we have a good crop, we discussed early, how do you decide what is viable farmland? A man comes in here and says, well, I'll go talk to the next door neighbor, and if beans are at 18 cents a pound, I'll buy bean land, and I'll pay $3,000 an acre at it. But what was it? In the last couple of 3 years, AgriPac and all of the canning have been paying 2 and 3 and 4 cents a pound for beans. They pay more for the can that the bean is delivered to the consumer in than the farmer gets. And as a consequence, many of the produce farmers are in bad straits because they cannot get the cash value for their crop. And in that instance, we have too damn much land in farmland. We've responded to that year by taking 82 million acres out of production. And it could go for 2 or 3 years as a result, as we looked at in the mid-50s and early 60s. How long were we in the land set-aside program? 10 years? For exactly the same reason. Overproduction was driving everybody to the bankruptcy wall. I have never heard anybody come before this committee nor the Senate committee that said, let's divide the state of Oregon up into 5-acre pieces. There has been a consistent pattern and a consistent concern of the small property owner that bought land 5, 10, 15, 2 years ago, but it's 5, 10, 15 acres. It is not a commercial farm under any concept, except possibly a strawberry grower or a tulip bulb grower or something that's an intensive farm operation. And there are few Americans that are intensive farmers. The strawberry people are screaming because the strawberries came on 2 weeks early and no one will pick strawberries. And we still have a 9% unemployment rate in the state. We have thousands of acres in Benton County alone that is devoted to Christmas tree growing. They get all of the benefits of the farming operation. They get the tax deferral. They get the income tax back off. They get the no property tax, personal property tax payment. And then on top of that, everything that they make is capital gain. And on a personal basis, I would submit that at this day and age, with the cover crop problem in the first 2 or 3 years of Christmas tree growing, that Christmas trees do more damage to the land than any other singular crop. But I still support the Christmas tree industry. But it's nothing but a cash crop. That's all it is. To a great extent, the ryegrass is a cash crop, and it adds to the economy. But it's so important to the economy that all of the small property owners are driven off of their property or not allowed to do with it what they bought it under the circumstances and planned for. And does it, in effect,